All right, so what I want to talk about, I want to talk about suffering today, and I've been asked to teach on self-reliance and self-sufficiency, and that's all that I have been told to do. I was not given the notes, so I made up my own notes. But last year, I did a workshop, I believe, here on self-sufficiency, self-reliance. I'm not going to do that again. But I want to add to it, if perchance you remember it, it's okay if you don't. But I want to talk about this idea of self-sufficiency. Self-sufficiency, synonym, self-reliance. It is one of our biggest problems. Everybody in this room struggles with self-reliance, relying on yourself. Trusting God is hard. And I'm talking about trusting God in our sanctification. Trusting God in our sanctification in many ways is harder than trusting God in our salvation. Trusting God in our salvation is a one-and-done deal. We ask God to save us. God imposes himself into our lives. He regenerates us, and we are born again. And if you were as naive as I was when God saved me, I thought it would be smooth sailing from that point forward. And I've had many what I call disappointments with God after he saved me. And those disappointments were based on this idea that I had in my mind that I was not going to suffer anymore, because one of the primary motivators for me to become a Christian is I wanted to not be so dysfunctional, be so messed up. And I got to the end of my rope, and I asked God to save me, and whatever words that I used that I don't remember anymore, it was October, I think, in 1984, I believe. And God, I believe, regenerated me at that point, and I was born again. I became a Christian, and everything was going to be fantastic after that, and everything was not fantastic. Things have been pretty messed up for me. And so it took me a while to begin to understand that God gave me two gifts at salvation, as Paul taught us in Philippians 1:29. For unto you it has been granted on the behalf of Christ not only to believe in him, salvation, but also to suffer for his sake. And so as a believer, you do receive two gifts. Gift number one, you are born again. Praise God. Gift number two, you are called to take up your cross and follow him. It is the gift of suffering and learning how to steward this gift. God's most feared blessing is really, really hard, because there is something within us that resists this idea of submission, resists this idea of humility, and we find it all the way back in the garden at Genesis 3:6, where Adam and Eve took a tumble in the garden. And when they tumbled, they became self-reliant people. They took matters into their own hands. They clothed themselves with fig leaves. They blamed one another. They ran from God. They used self-reliant means to take care of themselves. And God came along and said, "This will not work. You have to trust me." And trusting God in our salvation, as the man said in Mark 9:24, "Lord, I believe, but help my unbelief." And so we function as unbelieving believers, if I can play on those words. We are ontologically born again. We have a seat secured in heaven. It can never be taken away from us, as we learn in John 10:28, 29, and 30. It can never be taken away from us. However, living this life as a Christian requires a different kind of trust on a day-to-day basis. For example, for those of you who are married and you get in a little dust-up with your spouse, you have to ask yourself this question at that moment: am I going to trust God, or am I going to be self-reliant and take matters into my own hands? Self-reliance looks like snapping back at him or her, getting angry. That's what self-sufficiency looks like on the ground. I am going to bark back because I know that I can manipulate you into submitting. That's self-sufficiency. Or I can trust God and humble myself. For those of you who are parents, per chance that your children have ever sinned, it's highly probable. And you have two choices at that moment as a parent. Am I going to trust God in this moment and respond humbly and with maturity and walk my child through what they did? Or am I going to do what they do in football? Am I going to pile on to their sin? Piling on is a 15-yard penalty in football. And so your child is down for the count. He has sinned. And you take your anger and you jump on top of him. And now we have a pile of sinners in the middle of the living room. And you get flagged by God, if I can continue to push the illustration. Or my child sins and I choose to take it to God. God, I need your help right now. I want to be a redemptive representative. I want to be an ambassador for you right now. My child needs help. I don't want to complicate matters. God, I need you. My self-reliance is calling me to take matters into my own hands. That's what self-reliance looks like in two illustrations, but there are hundreds more. And so what I want to do this morning is I want to give you what I believe is Paul's theology of suffering. Paul had a sound, a robust, a comprehensive theology of suffering, and I want to share three verses with you in a logical sequence in the book of 2 Corinthians, and they are three mountaintop verses that communicate in the most succinct way Paul's robust theology of suffering. And so we're going to skip along these three mountaintop verses in 2 Corinthians, starting in chapter 1, and we'll finish in chapter 12. It's just three verses. It's all that we're going to take a look at this morning. And I promise you that if you can begin the mastering process, or said better, if you can begin to cooperate with God and allow these verses to master you, it will change your life. Now, let me footnote this here by saying it hasn't happened to me yet. I don't speak to you as one who has arrived. I am what they call a work in progress. And so I am still wrestling with these texts as well, but it is important for all of us to know where they are. Memorize them if you so desire. I would encourage you to do that. And then ask God to use these verses to master your mind so that you can come up under this idea of trusting God in your sanctification, so that you can resist self-reliance or self-sufficiency at every turn, because you will run into it every moment of your life. For example, I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but you're going down the road and someone does some traffic inconvenience. You know what a traffic inconvenience is? They cut you off, or they're texting at the traffic light. That's a good one. And it hinders you at least 2.3 seconds from your destination. And 2.3 seconds is important, because we track those things now on our watches. And I'm 2.3 seconds late for work because of that person who was so inconsiderate at the traffic light and hindered me. And I sat at the traffic light and it was green for 2.3 seconds. And so you have an opportunity in that moment to trust God or be self-reliant. Now, self-reliance can look like all kinds of things, blowing your horn or honking your horn, however y'all do it in California, Colorado. We blow our horns. It could be creative sign language. I'll not illustrate that, but there's ways of creatively giving sign language to let them know your disdain for them doing it. Or it could be, which may be more common, is to criticize them and grumble out loud so that that's called parental training. as you train everybody in the car or the van of how to respond to negative circumstances. And so it's just that simple, and it's the difference between being self-reliant or God-reliant in this mundane moment, which is all life is. Life is one long, mundane experience. There are only five highlights in your life that are worth talking about. One is your birth, of course. The second one is your second birth, of course. Marriage is your third highlight. Children are your fourth highlight. And death is your fifth one. Everything else is boring. Everything else is mundane. Those are the five big events in your life. Two of them are guaranteed. The first and last one. It's like going down in the Grand Canyon. They have a sign that says going down is, what they say, baby? Going down is optional, coming up is mandatory. Two of those are guaranteed. They're mandatory. The other three are optional. But life is mundane. And if we don't learn how to live Christ-like in the mundane moments of life, then we will be overcome by life. And so the first text that I want you to look at is in 2 Corinthians chapter 1. It's verses 8 and 9. And this is Paul setting the stage for his theology of suffering. And the first thing that he tells us in this text is, I don't want you to be ignorant. I don't want you to be unaware. And so Paul is talking to the most unaware people in his world, the Corinthians, and I think it's more than ironic that he is speaking to them. If there's any people that are going to misinterpret what is going on in Paul's life, the Corinthians will. And so Paul wants to make sure that they don't misinterpret what is happening to him. Now, what is happening to Paul and to his team is they're going through great affliction in Asia. And so you could paraphrase this passage this way. And so you're at the intersection and brush, and you get that delay at the traffic light. It's your turn to go, but there's a teenager in front of you texting. And so what you would want to say to everybody in the car at that moment is, I don't want you to be ignorant of the affliction that is happening to me at this intersection. And you can share that with your children, because your children could... they could start being critical of the texting teenager. Not that, no offense to all teenagers or texting adult. Oh, okay, teenagers, the old person sitting at the traffic light who can't see. And they're just sitting there and it goes from red to green. Now, that's me, the living coupon who can't see. I have eye trouble besides being stricken with age. But whoever it is that's detaining you at the traffic light, the parent says to the children in the car, I don't want you to be unaware of the affliction that's happening to me in this car. And it is important that you communicate to everybody in your world, because this is what you have to do to people. You have to train people, because people will upload their own interpretations to what you are going through. Let's say you're going through a significant grief, more than traffic lights and parental disruptions and marital dust-ups, maybe death in your family or divorce or loss of job, the bigger things in life. And it is imperative, and this is one of the things that I have had to learn and in my years of living and through significant hardships that I have gone through, is that not only do I have to be the sufferer, but I have to be the teacher too. I have to walk people through what I'm going through, because they can take it to the wrong place. And this is what Paul is doing. He is the sufferer, but he is always, always helping people to understand from a God-centered, Christocentric perspective what's going on in his life, because he doesn't want them to misunderstand the affliction and how easy it is. And so he says, I don't want you to be unaware, brothers, of the affliction that we experienced in Asia. For we were so utterly burdened beyond our strength. And that is the key phrase there that we really want to pull out of the text and highlight. Burden beyond our strength. Now, that is a good thing. That is a positive thing. It is kind of God to take such an interest in us that He would push us beyond our ability to rectify the situation. God has to push us beyond our strength. He has to push us beyond our ingenuity, our contrivances, our ability to conjure up escape routes and other ways to tackle this problem. Now, He will explain to us later as we look at another verse as to why it's imperative that God, in His mercy to us, that He will put us in places that we can't get out of under our own power. This is why He wanted the Corinthians not to be unaware of the affliction that He was going through, that they were going through in Asia. Because they could look at Paul and say, "Look at what you are going through, Paul. Poor Paul. How can we help you through this? I can't believe what they have done to you, Paul. You are a victim," which is the perfect message for our country, because everybody is a victim. And Paul did not want them to go there. And so he took the lead in his own suffering and said, "I don't want you to be ignorant of the affliction that we experienced in Asia, for we were utterly burdened beyond our strength." But it got worse than that we even despaired of life itself. "Indeed, we felt that we had received the sentence of death." Now, I don't know, and it's impossible to know, all that was going on in Paul's life at this time in this scenario that he's articulating here in a general way, as it is impossible for anyone to know all the details of the difficulties that you go through. But it is obviously bad for Paul and his team to the point that they were despairing of life. I have been there on more than one occasion, and I'm sure that some of you have been to that place as well. It is the end of the rope. "Indeed, I felt like I had received the sentence of death." But Paul gives us that great divine conjunction. As you know, grammatically, conjunction joins two thoughts. And so he says, "But that was to make us rely not on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead." Now, this is profound theology here as it pertains to suffering. If you can be mastered by this text, you will be a free person, not controlled and not managed by circumstances. As you learn to take the sufferings in your life, the difficulties, the challenges in your life, and seeing God in those challenges. Of course, it's an echo of 50-20 in Genesis, where Joseph said, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." You see that same idea that Paul is articulating here. There are two questions that we want to ask when suffering happens, but the order in which you ask these questions are important. And the first question is the vertical question. God, what are you doing? It's an appropriate question because you want God's mind. You have to have God's mind on what is happening. You want to discern as much as you can subjectively discern God's mind in this situation because you want to be governed and managed by God. I remember when my first brother was murdered in June of 1987, that was the first question that I asked. "God, what meanest thou this? God, what is..." That's King James. I'm fluent in King James, by the way. And I love the King James Bible. Makes me sound smart. My brother said that he said, "You cry ugly and you don't sound that great." And that's all right. And sometimes I quote King James just to spiff up the place and make me feel intelligent. And so I went to the Lord and I said, "What meanest thou this?" after my brother was murdered, because I wanted to understand. I wanted to have God's mind on this situation. I didn't want to go into the situation without God's mind. And so that's the first question. Now, what you want to do is you want to train yourself this way. Because those illustrations that I used earlier about a disruptive child or a disruptive spouse, at the heat of the moment, you're not going to be able, okay, I want to ask the vertical question first. Dear Lord, why is my child throwing things against the wall? No, you're not going to be able to do that. And so what you want to do is you want to have spiritual muscle memory. You want to train yourself until that is your automatic reflex. That's just how you reflect when bad stuff happens. And it takes training to be able to do that. If you wait until the crisis to come, you don't have this much time to respond in a millisecond. That's just not how it works. And so it's kind of like kinesthetic memory, you know, typing without looking at the keys, riding your bicycle without looking at the pedals. And so you want to train yourself spiritually, kinesthetically, spiritual training, so that you can respond in a reflex way. God, what does this mean? What are you trying to accomplish here? I want to discern your mind. And then the second question that you ask is the horizontal question. Then now you're ready to react and engage the situation. But if you engage the situation first and then come to God secondly, probably 100 times out of 100, you're going to get that wrong. And so you want to train yourself. The self-reliant person will react first, and then maybe go to God later if they go to God at all. The God-reliant person will react first by going to God, and then they will engage the situation. So when affliction comes to Paul, he doesn't want you to be unaware of the stuff that is happening to him, because he has already gone to God. He has the mind of Christ as much as he can have the mind of Christ. And he knows that he's got an idea of what God is teaching him, and he tells them here, he's teaching me not to rely on myself. You see, Paul had enough self-awareness that he knew that he was a self-reliant person. Now, we know Paul's pedigree. Paul was a large capacity individual. Paul had a tremendous intellect. He had much ability, as he teaches us, as we learn in Philippians. And so if anyone will be tempted to rely on themselves, it would be a person with great ability. And this is the problem that all of us have. Your greatest strength is your greatest weakness. Your greatest strength is your biggest liability. Because what we do is we rely on our strengths, and it's our strengths that we use over and over again to get us out of the messes that we are in. In fact, our strengths can be our biggest idolatry. And in most of us, our strengths are our biggest idolatry. And an unguarded strength, as Oswald Chambers said, is a double weakness. And so we want to guard our strengths. In fact, I would encourage you to practice guarding your strength more than you guard your weaknesses. We tend to guard the front door where the weaknesses are, but it's the back door where our strengths are. And then there's a double danger there, because people applaud our strengths. People see our ability and they applaud it, and it becomes an ego trip if we're not careful. And then our strengths, our talents, our gifts can become our idolatries, and we begin to rely on them. And God in His mercy can bring us to a place to where we can't use those strengths like we used to, and He teaches us to, because He wants us to rely on Him. Now, it's interesting here at the end of the verse, in verse number 9, and I think it's important as we understand the gospel, the comprehensive nature of the gospel. The gospel is eternal. The gospel begins, there's no beginning, in eternity past, and the gospel goes into the eternity future. The gospel has always been and always will be. The gospel came to earth, the good news, in the person of Christ. And when Paul is thinking about, so the gospel is multifaceted. I like to say the gospel is like a multifaceted diamond. Every turn of the diamond, you see a new facet of the gospel. But it's important that when Paul is talking about self-reliance here, the facet of the gospel that he points you to is the resurrection. He says, God is teaching me not to rely on myself,
but to rely on him who raises the dead. He did not say, I want you to rely on him who was born in a manger. He didn't say, I want you to rely on him who died on a cross, because there were a lot of people who were born in a manger. There were a lot of people that died on a cross. But I want you to rely on him who raises the dead. When it comes to your and my self-reliance, when it becomes to our greatest weakness, we need the greatest power to confront our greatest weakness. And Paul wanted to make sure that when you dial in on the gospel at this point, that it is the resurrection, because nobody can do that. You can't do it. I can't do it. Only God can bring a man out of the grave. And if you're going to rely on someone, you need to rely on someone who has that kind of power. He transcends all humanity. He transcends all ingenuity. Only God can bring a man out of the grave. He is the one I want you to rely on. And I think it's imperative. I don't think this is an accident, as inspired by the Holy Spirit, as Paul is writing here, that he would point to this aspect of the gospel. There is one person that we can rely on who transcends all other powers, and it is God. And he brings people out of the grave. You can trust him. And so, Corinthians, I do not want you to be ignorant. That is the King James word, by the way. But in the ESV I have here, I don't want you to be unaware, my brothers, of what we're going through. And so whatever crisis you have that you are going through, this is your mantra. This is what you want to learn to say, not as a parrot says it, but as a person who has been riveted and transformed by these two verses. And so when you go through that hardship, big or small, I want you to be able, and I want to be able to say to those who are experiencing, who are looking through the window of my hardship, I want you to be able to say, I don't want you to be unaware of what I am going through. God is here, and he is teaching me not to rely on myself, but to rely on him who raises the dead. This is the primary thing that I'm learning. Now, I want to give a big footnote here, and it's important, because one of the things that I've seen in our ministry, and I've seen a lot of it in our ministry, is that people come to us from all over the world, and everybody that comes to us has a problem. That's what we do. And so nobody comes to us struggling with joy. Everybody comes to us with a problem. And so that's the nature of our business. That's our ministry. But there are quite a few people who come to us and they will say, I know that, you know, I just need to trust God more. I know God is teaching me. And they say it in such a way that it's like I'm supposed to stay this way in this suffering for the rest of my life, whatever this suffering may be. And so I want you to be discerning, and I want you to, or they'll say, you know, Christ died on the cross. Oh, this is a common one. Christ died on the cross. He suffered, so I should suffer. And there is a resignation. There is a giving up there, when in some situations, being God-reliant doesn't mean you have to stay in the suffering all the time. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't use wisdom and discernment to get out from under it. Let's say that one of the common things, one of the common situations that comes into our ministry is abusive marriages, for example. And I'll hear either the husband or the wife, whoever's being abused, and they will say, well, you know, Jesus suffered, and so I'm suffering too. Jesus carried his cross, and so I need to carry my cross. And there's an element of truth there, but there's also another element. It's like, you need to leave. You know, you need to get away from this. And so what I don't want you to hear in these texts or to upload into this text is, yeah, God is teaching me not to be self-reliant, but that doesn't mean I should stay in Asia all my life. And so that's a discerning thing, and you have to make that decision in community as you talk to your pastor or you talk to someone that's helping you walk through it. Paul didn't stay in the same locale all of his life. He left. He learned the lesson. He's learning the lesson, but he left. And I think that is important. And so I don't want you to take this over interpretation of carrying your cross and just groveling through life miserably when maybe God is offering. I mean, Job walked out of his crucible with many hurts, of course, and many losses, but he wasn't in his crucible forever. And so I don't want you to overhear what I'm saying, if that makes sense. I don't want you to miss the lesson of being learning how to be God-reliant, but I also want you to be discerning as well, depending on the circumstance that you are going through. And so Paul was giving us in 2 Corinthians 1, 8 and 9, this idea. Now, he's going to make it a little more personal as we move along. The second verse that I want you to see is in chapter 4. In chapter 4, verse number 7, it's one sentence, and it's the verse, the only verse that we'll focus on here. Paul takes this idea of self-reliance versus God-reliance, and now he gives us this great juxtaposition. He takes a jar of clay and a treasure, and he juxtaposes them. He puts them side by side, and he says that we have this treasure in jars of clay, to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. This is the metaphor that I was speaking of earlier about this building. This building, in that sense, is a jar of clay, a peeling old building that is beautiful. But it's not about the building. You don't go to church. Nobody goes to church, as in this is the church. This is a building. You are the church. You are the treasure. But to bring it into the text, Paul is talking about you individually. You are a jar of clay. I am a jar of clay. And this has an echo of Genesis 2:7. In Genesis 2:7, it says, the Lord God formed man out of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. We came out of the dust of the ground. To the dust we shall go. And so Paul recognizes what our physical bodies are. We are a jar of clay. We are a recyclable pot. A penny a dozen. Not even a dime a dozen. A penny a dozen. You chip one and one breaks. In the context of a jar, it's not that important. You just make another one. It's just not a valuable thing. And that's true in that sense. But then he says that we have the treasure in the jar of clay. Now the jar of clay is really important. I've seen some people overreact to our cultural self-esteem movement. Self-esteem is a bad teaching for a lot of reasons, and I won't go into that here. But in our effort to counteract self-esteem, we have something that's, it's like worm theology. I'm just no good. I'm just a jar of clay. No, you are highly valuable. You're made in the image of God. Your value is derived from the value of the Creator. The creation is not worth much if the Creator is not worth much. Brandy's got a Van Gogh on her wall. Is that an original? Let's just pretend that it's an original. How much would that thing cost? Hundreds of millions. The reason it would cost hundreds of millions is because it's a Van Gogh. Let's say you had a Ricky T on your wall that looked like that. And honestly, when I look at Van Gogh, I think I could do that. No offense for you paint aficionado, painting people. I just don't know much about painting. But I think I could do that, or some version of that. And if you took a Ricky T and a Van Gogh down to the flea market, I mean, the Van Gogh is going to go for millions of dollars. And my little thing is going to go for, if you get $1.50 out of it, how much you say? I appreciate wit. That was witty. He was making a reference to this. It's a great time for a commercial anyway. He was making a reference to my book here. If you don't have these books, thank you. You can pick yours up at the back for $250. Where were we? If you flea market. And so if you go to the flea market, mine is $12. That's a stretch. I appreciate the compliment, but that is really a stretch. But it's not about the painting per se. It's the creator of the painting. We are valuable in that sense because God of the universe created us. We are made in his image. And so we want to be careful as we're confronting this nonsense of self-esteem that we don't devalue ourselves as though we're not important because the creator made us. And Paul is saying that this jar of clay has the treasure in us. Now, this is the point that I want you to get. And he tells us why this is important. The last part of the sentence. We have this treasure in jars of clay. Why? To show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. Now, here's the problem. None of us wants to be a jar of clay. We want to be somebody. We want to be pretty, healthy, wealthy, wise. We want to paint the barn. And I mean, this is why I look the way I do, all ripped out and studly-like, which you have observed. We want to have the right house. We want to have the right spouse. We want to have the right car. We want to have the right job. We don't like being a jar of clay is the point. And Paul said, and sometimes God has to, this is what he said in chapter 1. He has to push us beyond our strength. He has to remind us, no, at the end of the day, you are a jar of clay. You can paint it all you want to paint. Now, I'm not against painting the jar. You can paint it all you want. You can put whatever you want on it. But you ain't it. It's the treasure. God will not compete with us. And if it's going to be your strength versus his strength, he'll let you go. And there's a chapter, Romans 1, that talks about that. And it's a bad path if you keep going down that path. But there will not be these two strengths that are just going to push along. That's not how it works here. Somebody has got to be the jar of clay. Somebody has got to be the treasure. And that rubs against our proud selves. I don't want to be that broken, vulnerable. Here's the word. Here's the kryptonite. Weak. I don't want to be weak. I don't want to be vulnerable. I don't want to be a jar of clay. I want to be somebody. And that is the antagonistic message, the hostile message of self-esteem. I want to be somebody. I want to be important. And Paul's saying, no, we are a jar of clay, and it's important that we become a jar of clay, to use the illustration, so that when somebody drives by and they see this building, and it's like, wow, building needs some help. That building is old, it's peeling, dirty road. And then they walk in here, and it's pow! Whoa! Treasure! And it is so contrary to what this building looks like. Happy people, loving people, praising people. It's like, how can that be? And that's what Paul was saying in this text, to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. If you all into yourself and you want to be great and you want to be the power, you want to be the strength, and they look at you, that's exactly what they're going to see. There's the glory, that jar. I want to be like that jar. There's no power. There's really no treasure. There's nothing there eternal. It's just a temporary, beautiful, strong, rich pot with all the accoutrements of this world, but there's really nothing there. It's a fading leaf at the end of the day. It is a vapor, as James said. Paul says, no. And this is what he's teaching the Corinthians. God was doing this to us in Asia because he was pushing us beyond our pretty pot so we could take the position of a jar of clay so people would see that the power is in here, and then there is no answer for this other than God is alive. There's no other explanation for what is going on in your life but the power of God. And that's what we want to do. To show, to communicate, the surpassing power belongs to God, not to us. The third text, the last text, is in chapter 12. This is the personal illustration. Paul was giving you theory up to this point. Now he's going to make it personal with himself. And what he basically says in chapter 12 is that I have a propensity to be proud. I have many strengths, many abilities. I have great capacity. And because of that, I can be proud. Now, God in his mercy to me, he sends a messenger of Satan to harass me. I don't want you to be ignorant of what God is doing. And because of the abundant revelations that were given to me, and because I can be proud, or the way he says it in verse 7, of becoming conceited because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, this is where your strength becomes your greatest weakness. He said, the Lord sent a messenger, Satan, to harass me, to keep me from becoming conceited. And Paul did what you should do. He asked God three times, that this thing should, would you take this harassment away from me? And God said, no, my grace is sufficient for you. Here's the juxtaposition of the jar and clay again that I want you to see. God's power and my weakness. There's the treasure. There's the jar of clay right there. My power, and that's what he said in verse 7, so that the surpassing power, that everybody would see the surpassing power in your jar of clay. He's saying it again here, but he's really making it personal. God said, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is perfected in your weakness. In fact, my power can only be perfected in your weakness. My power cannot be perfected in your power. My power cannot be perfected in your strength. My power cannot be perfected in your ability. My power is perfected in your weakness, your vulnerability, your hardship, your difficulty, your affliction. God, in his kindness to Paul, brought him to a place of brokenness beyond his ability to rectify the situation, as he said in verse 8, beyond my strength. Now, there's a transition here. Paul says, therefore, I will boast all the more gladly. And I laugh at that verse because they're my two favorite life verses, this is one of them, are my two favorite texts in Scripture are not in the Bible. My two favorite texts of Scripture aren't there. And my two favorite spots in the Bible aren't there. I don't have two favorite verses. I have two favorite spots, and they're blanks. And one of them is right here. It's the blank or the space between weakness and therefore. There's a gap between the word weakness and therefore. Now, if you read verse 9 all the way through, which I wouldn't recommend that you read this verse all the way through. There's two sentences there. So God said, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, will I boast all the more glad in my weakness, so that the present power of Christ rests upon me. I don't think that's a good reading of that verse, because this has not been my experience. It has not been my experience for God to say, I'm not going to give you what you want. Oh, okay, I will rejoice all the more gladly. It doesn't happen that quickly for me, is what I'm saying. Usually when God gives me bad news, it takes me anywhere from a month or, or two to recover. and to begin to process what God is doing in me before I can accept this hard reality in my life. But if you speed read this text here, it's a, God says, no, I'm not going to, let me give you a paraphrase. I'm not going to change your situation. You're going to have this thorn in the flesh for the rest of your life. Okay, I'll boast all the more gladly. Does it happen that quickly for you? Now, maybe you're more spiritual than I am, but it takes me a while to transition from the bad news to a Christocentric, really living in God's power. And so the gap between weakness and therefore, I wrote an article a few years ago, the day after my mother died, 2013, 5 years ago now, I suppose. And at the bottom of the article, it was just a thing about my mother dying the night before. At the bottom of the article, I said something, you know, rejoice, whatever. And I said, tell Paul I have questions. And what I meant in that article, which nobody would know, but this is the question I have for Paul, is how long did it take you to reorient yourself from hearing the bad news that your situation ain't going to ever change to boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may rest upon me? I'm asking Paul that question. It's a legitimate question. Did it take you 5 minutes, 5 seconds, 5 days, 5 years? How long did it take you? Because if you just, again, if you speed read this verse, you'll miss it. But the gap between weakness and therefore is profound. And I suspect that most of us in this room need a longer gap between hearing some bad news, whatever it may be, and reorient ourselves to a Christocentric way of responding to that bad news. And I just got to know. And so I'll be asking Paul. The second spot in the Bible is the last verse of Joshua chapter 2. when they made a decision to cross the Jordan River. Anyway, you can read that later. I was just curious as to what went on the night before as Joshua was planning on crossing the river. And then the next verse begins, they cross the river. And as I read that text many years ago, I just thought, what did y'all talk about? It's like this is a big deal. Like, what went on? There's like no information. It's like, you know, here's what we got to do. And boom, boom, next day. They walk across. There's a gap between the two verses, and I'm into what's not there. I love the Bible. I love the Bible so much. I love the spots in the Bible, but those are two of my favorite spots. But this is number one right here. And so Paul says, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses. Here's the juxtaposition of the jar again with the treasure, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. And then he says in verse 10, for the sake of Christ, then I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships. This is what I want you to put on your bumper sticker or your t-shirt. This is a great bumper sticker. I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I'm weak, then I am strong. Ain't that a great bumper sticker? An excellent t-shirt. This is the secret to life right here. His last sentence of verse 10 is the secret to life. If you want a great life, this short sentence has to own you. For when I'm weak, then I am strong. And there's two points to where it has to own you. The first one is salvation. The only way you can be saved is to be weak. Accept your fallenness. Accept the fact that you're going to hell. Accept the fact that you can't save yourself. Accept the fact that there is nothing in this world that you can do to make yourself better. We are weak, we are broken, and we need God. And that's the first point where you begin to own this text, or it begins to own you. And then you cry out to God, I am weak, I am lost, I am blind. Lord, save me, and then you will be strong, because the power will come into you. Now, the second point, and I'm going to assume that most of us in here are born again. This is what I was saying earlier. In many ways, it's the harder part, because we have to embrace our weakness on a moment-by-moment basis. And we need to train ourselves on a moment-and-moment basis and resist our strengths and understand that when hardship comes into our life, that God is teaching us, He's pushing us beyond our ability. And so whatever our ability is, if this is the totality, this square here, if this is the totality of all my power and all my ingenuity, God will push me beyond this. And I have to become comfortable in living out here. And as I become comfortable living out here, my comfortableness will be in proportion that I am appropriating God's grace into my life to live beyond my ability. And that's what Paul said here. My grace, or that's what God said, my grace is sufficient for you. One last text, and I'll just mention it in passing because it's a perfect illustration of what I'm talking about. And it was Peter walking on the water in Matthew 14. The boat on the water on that dark and stormy night was self-sufficiency. It was Peter in control of the situation. He was on the boat and he was safe. God, in His kindness to Peter, came walking on the water, and he was over yonder. And Christ asked Peter to step off the boat. And it is a perfect illustration of what Paul was talking about here. Christ was calling Peter to step beyond his ability. And so if this platform is the boat, which we'll call SS for self-sufficiency, Christ was out there. And he says, Peter, if you really want to experience me, if you want to enjoy God in the most profound way, then you've got to walk on the wild side. You've got to get off of that boat. Now, I know that many people ping Peter for falling in the water and blundering and being impulsive. That's not my perspective. I have no criticism of Peter on that night, because what Peter did was unbelievable. What Peter did is he got off the boat and he walked on the water, and it's the most profound thing. And I have thought many years when Peter, if I can make up a story here, I'm preaching, so I should be able to, just a little preaching humor there. Maybe it was very little. But I imagine Peter as an old man walking by the Sea of Galilee, and the little kids come up to him. And, hey, Mr. Peter, would you tell us that story again? Would you tell us that story about that night when you, like, did you really do that? Did you step out of a boat and walk on water? I mean, I've seen the flannel graph in my Sunday school class, and I just want to hear it from you. And Mr. Peter said, "All glory be to God. This is what Christ did." Yeah, I was shaking in my thongs, and I probably shouldn't have said that. I was shaking in my boots, and I got out of the boat, and I was a nervous wreck. But the most important part of that text, if you go back and read it, there's two words in that text that is stunning. When Peter began to sink, he cried out to God. And the text says, "Jesus, immediately." Those are the two most beautiful words that you'll ever read in a moment like that. He cried out to God. And the text says, Jesus immediately reached out his hand and lifted him up. There's not two more beautiful words put together, Jesus immediately. Paul is saying that God has pushed me beyond my strength. But it was to teach me not to rely on myself, but him who raises the dead, him who pulls us up out of the water. because there's a key to that text in Matthew 14 and Psalm 23:3. You know the verse in 23:3. He leads me in paths of righteousness. And then in the King James, there's a colon there. And a colon grammatically means, I'm going to explain what I just said. And so he says, he leads me in paths of righteousness. Or he says, no, I'm sorry, he says, he restores my soul is how it begins. Now, if he just left it at he restores my soul, we wouldn't know what that meant. Okay, he restores my soul. But there's a colon there. And so he tells us how he restores our soul. He leads us in paths of righteousness. Now, there's more to that than that, but what I want to point to in that verse is the very last part. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. See, suffering's not about us. It's God's name that's on the line. God called Peter to get out of that boat. There's no way in the world Peter was going to sink that night. I mean, God's name is on the line. I am calling you. And Paul understood this when it came to the suffering that he went through. This is not about me. This is God that is putting me in a place so that his fame can just be magnified, and I'm going to be okay. His grace is sufficient for me. He's going to take care of me in this crucible of suffering. He is going to restore my soul. And that's what suffering does. It has a restoring effect. He's going to do that by leading me down paths of righteousness. So I'm going to keep walking down these paths. I'm going to pray. I'm going to read my Bible. I'm going to go to my church meetings. I'm going to fellowship with the saints. I'm going to tell people about Christ. Those are all paths of righteousness. Because what we tend to do when trouble comes, we recoil. We draw in, we withdraw, we isolate, we alienate ourselves from the community of faith. No, this is how my soul's going to be restored. I am going through suffering. God's going to use this to restore my soul. I'm going to keep walking down these paths as hard as they may be because God's name is on the line. Jesus immediately will lift you out of that water as you go through your trouble. You have one question to answer. Am I going to get out of the boat? Am I going to do the hard thing? Am I going to set aside my self-reliance and learn how to trust God in this crucible of suffering? Let's pray. Father, thank you for the story of Paul. Thank you for his transparency, that he would be so willing to share so much of his life and the things that he had learned from you and that he is teaching us these 2,000 years later. God, would you help us to learn these lessons, that we see our hardships as opportunities, that we know that our first question is to you and that you're teaching us not to rely on ourselves, but we can rely on you who raised the dead. And we know that you will immediately reach out your hand and give us the help that we need in these moments of despair. And Lord, may your fame grow through these moments as we are matured into Christ-likeness. Lord, help us. And Father, I pray specifically for this body, not for them individually, but as they think about it personally, but as they come alongside each other. And I know there will be times when someone will need to remind the other of this message when they go through their hardship and they forget these things and they get their eye off the Christocentric ball. And so, Lord, I pray that this body here will be attentive to the needs of each other and remind each other of these wonderful lessons in 2 Corinthians. And God, help us to always be vigilant in defeating our desire to cover ourselves with fig leaves, to run away from your help, to blame each other and all those other Adamic tendencies that we have. And Lord, teach us to rely on you exclusively. We cry out to you as jars of clay, and may others see the surpassing power that is in us. We ask you to do these good things in us because we cannot do them for ourselves. In Christ's name, amen.